Be good.
Well, hey, hi, hello there, friends and strangers. Welcome to the program. It's Andrew, if you don't know, and this is, in fact, the Monkey Tooth Podcast. I'm super glad you're here today, because I got a hell of a guest for you. His name is Joshua Davis, and I'll tell you about him in a second. But the only reason I was able to talk to Mr. Davis is our mutual friend, Jim O'Connor, is just an advocate, man. He's just like a good friend, a sweet guy. And makes a compelling case, I guess, for yours truly. Because I can tell you, I did not write some super compelling email to Josh Davis asking him to be on the show. It's all Jim. So thanks, Jim. Mighty kind. Joshua Davis, what a guy. For sure, one of the more busy people I've ever encountered. He is a writer, New York Times bestselling author. He's got a magazine that he's running, co-founded Epic Magazine. He's producing films and television programs, and not the least of which, he's in the middle of releasing a fantastic podcast with Kyle MacLachlan, who you may know from Twin Peaks and Dune, the originals. Joshua is a busy guy, and their podcast, Varnamtown, it's fantastic. It's so, so good. We're going to talk about that in a bit. I'll put links up if you want to see it or find it. I highly recommend it. Varnamtown, V-A-R-N-A-M, Town, Varnamtown. Well, there's not a lot of housekeeping to be done here. Tiff and I are going to Los Angeles next week. We're going to go see Vera Sola at Gold Diggers in Los Angeles. A live show. It's weird for me. So if you're in that area and you want to say, reach out and say hi, please do. I've got some great guests coming up. Very excited to talk to some more artists and performers. And if you've got a guest that you'd like us to meet or talk to, please reach out, connect us. I'm always looking for interesting people. And and I've got a trip planned this spring in May. I will be driving from Larkspur, California to New York City. And then Tiffany and I are going to spend some time on the East Coast in the Northeast, and then we're going to drive slowly back. So if you're on our route, reach out. I'm looking for people to talk to for so many reasons, to give Tiffany a break, to give Pele a break, and to give me something to look forward to. All right. Enjoy this episode with Joshua. I most certainly did. Until next time, adios. Oh, and thank you one more time, Jim O'Connor. You're the best.
I like stories. Yeah, I like talking to people.
No shit. No shit. First of all, thanks.
Welcome to the library.
It's super, super kind of you to take time. You're objectively one of the busier people I think I've ever met. I don't often prepare much to talk to people because it's usually spur of the moment, but I've had plenty of opportunity to prepare to talk to you, and it's been one of the more fun experiences diving into somebody's work, because you've done a lot of sort of similar things, but the scope of it is just crazy. And everything is more interesting than the next.
Well, glad you feel that way. I don't often look backwards, so this will be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I'll try not to get it too far backwards. Yeah,
I don't mind.
Yeah. I mean, your most recent past is pretty interesting to me, because you're in the middle of a thing.
The last 4 hours.
Yeah.
You mean my most recent past? It's been an interesting 4 hours.
Yeah. What happened today?
The Guardian ran a story about my experience with Kyle MacLachlan trying to chase down these rumors of Pablo Escobar's operations in the Carolinas in the United States in the 1980s.
Varnamtown.
Varnamtown.
I'm a big fan of, I mean, just storytelling in general, but for sure, the style, the approach that you guys have taken on this has just been, it's getting funnier as well, which like it was kind of funny at first, but each episode gets progressively more insane.
I think that's true. I really feel that the show builds, and by the time you get to like episode 6 and 7 are particularly wacky.
Yeah. I mean, the things that you promise in the beginning are enough to hook anybody. You guys did a really good job of selecting the things that are upcoming.
Yeah. I just actually finished yesterday editing episode 8, which features our interview with the governor of North Carolina, the former governor,
yeah,
Mike Easley, who was the prosecutor who prosecuted all the cases coming out of Varnamtown.
Oh my God. I can't imagine what that guy had to say.
He had a lot of great things to say. He remembers it vividly, even though it was 30 years ago. But he was a young prosecutor. He was fresh out of law school, and he took this job in Brunswick County, had no idea what to expect, and ended up discovering that this, what he thought was this very sleepy backwater, was in fact a major, major cocaine transshipment area, much bigger than the big cities, to the north and to the south.
Well, there's so much of it that I want people to dial into, and we'll talk some more about Varnamtown. But like what you do is interesting enough to me. But the approach, the mindset, like how you actually find, like for instance, you're talking to the ex-governor, and you know there's something that needs to be understood and then transcended in dealing with the unreliability of the eyewitness account. So like, how do you? Because you're a truth seeker. You're not just a storyteller. You're trying to find what's the real story here.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine in Varnamtown, especially, you're getting many varied accounts of how this went down. So how are you as a journalist finding, what's your barometer like? What's your process for?
Well, I talked to as many people as I could, and many of them said not completely different things, but oftentimes there were facts that were not the same. So like when the DEA is talking about how many years a particular defendant was facing, one agent will say 48 years. The other agent will say 1,200 years. That was actually the disparity. it wasn't even like 48 to 52. It was 48 to 1,200.
Jesus.
So what can you do? We did our best to look at the court records,
right?
The contemporaneous accounts, whatever little newspaper reporting there was. But at the same time, there's some things that we just couldn't confirm, and so we present that to the listener and say, "Hey, this is it's a little frustrating, but it's also interesting because people have such different memories of the same thing, and that in and of itself is a fact."
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a fact of any given place. But when there's something so outrageous that has happened, which is, seems to be sort of your specialty, it's finding the outrageous.
Yeah. I am interested in the absurd, I guess. And so what is the absurd? Things that don't make sense to us in the normal course of affairs. And I guess part of my attraction to that is we all get into a routine and we think, oh, this is the way things are. And then you hear a story that is so far outside that routine that it shakes you and you're like, oh, maybe I didn't understand the world.
Yeah.
And maybe there's more out there than I'm willing to accept, or I'm prepared to accept, or I thought, it expands our horizons essentially. I think also it helps us when you hear somebody's story that is so different than yours, but then ultimately you're like, oh, now I get it. Now I understand why that person did what they did or thinks what they think. That's really important to me.
Part of what fascinates me about your style of telling the story, but also the subjects that you're looking for, is that very thing. And there's a lot to know about you to, in my opinion, like get a full appreciation for the stories that you're trying to tell. I almost see like you trying to, this could be totally off base, but contextualize yourself through these sort of absurd characters. I don't know, your approach of finding these misfits and these oddballs, to me, is there something that you're trying, that you're looking for in yourself?
There has to be. I think initially with The Underdog, which for me, that was kind of the early part of my career in the aughts. It wasn't intentional. I, at the time, was working as a data entry clerk here in San Francisco at the phone company, and it wasn't very exciting. And I wanted a more exciting life, but you still have to make money and you have to live. And so I didn't quite know how to do that. And I saw this flyer for the U.S. National Arm Wrestling Championship. And I thought, huh, that's kind of different and interesting. And it was in Laughlin, Nevada. And so it was on the weekend, and I thought, well, let me just go check it out. The weekends became very important to me at that time because my Monday through Friday was so dead. So I drove out to Laughlin, and I was just going to go as a spectator and check it out and have an interesting experience at the Avi Hotel Resort and Casino. And the organizers, when I went up to buy a ticket, said, I think it was like free as a spectator, but they're like, you've driven all this way, why don't you compete? It's like, that's not my intention. I have never really arm wrestled before. That seems like a barrier to entry. But they're like, no, it's fine. I think it was $20. And so I was like, oh, okay, you know, let's go with the spirit of it. And they introduced me to this guy, Rick Salawada, because I said, look, I don't know anything. I need somebody to just give me the basics of even what to do up there. What's the protocol? And so they introduced me to Rick Salawada, who was the middleweight champ at the time. He was from Erie, Pennsylvania. He was a plumber, and he had taken Greyhound all the way across the country to Nevada for this event. This was like a major thing in his life. He was pretty frosty with me. I found out later that he had deliberately stopped smoking cigarettes when he left Erie, so that by the time he got to Laughlin, he'd be really pissed off and ready to arm wrestle. And so I got a little bit of that. But he was like, okay, here's what you do. There's only two moves really in arm wrestling, the inside move and the outside move. And he taught me that and said, good luck. And so I got up there, and I was in the lightweight division, essentially. And it was a double elimination event. So you lose twice and you're out. And I lost twice, which was totally expected and fine, and I had a very good time. And everybody, particularly Rick, after he dominated, he won, and then he was super happy and warm, and right. I saw another side of Rick. Just a great guy. I met Jeff Tomchason, who was the world heavyweight champion at the time, great guy from Texas. And I was just sitting in the back with them drinking Budweiser's when they started the awards ceremony. And out of the kind of corner of my ear, I hear them say, in the lightweight division, fourth place in the United States, Joshua Davis, get on up here. And I'm like, what? I thought there was a mistake, obviously, because I had lost all my matches. But I went up there and they slapped me on the back and they said, congratulations, you're fourth out of four.
Yeah.
There were no other competitors in the lightweight division. And that made me an alternate for the U.S. National Arm Wrestling Team. And when numbers 2 and 3 couldn't go, they were forced by their bylaws to invite me to become part of Team USA. And so I ended up going to Poland to represent America in the World Arm Wrestling Championship, having never won a match in my life. And that was the beginning of something for me. That really, that changed the way I viewed the world and the way I approached the world. Because essentially, just by kind of putting myself out there and going on that little weekend trip, I met all these new people who I would never have met otherwise. I met a whole bunch more people as this experience progressed, as I became part of the American arm wrestling team. I got to represent my country. I took it very seriously after that. I went to Texas and I trained with Jeff Tomchesson. I had only qualified with my right arm, and I had to stay within my weight class. So I kind of emaciated the left side of my body, and I had just one giant right arm. My friends started calling me the crab. but it was fun. It was exciting. I felt connected to people in a way that I hadn't before. And I thought, oh, this is what I should be doing.
Were you, because you said you went to school for finance or something entirely different, right?
I studied economics and on the one hand, and I got a degree in what was called modern thought and literature.
Okay. So you were already writing?
I was, I didn't study writing, but I think I viewed myself as a writer.
Yeah.
But I didn't study it. I don't know. I didn't feel like college was, for whatever reason, for me, the right place to study writing. Yeah. I've always had to me, the idea of studying writing when I was younger seemed not consistent with the idea of the freedom of writing. I feel differently now, by the way, as a older person.
Well, yeah, I mean, writing is obviously a very experiential thing. It's better when coming from some point of view or an experience, but there is a craft to it. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. Like having learned, and I really, I've been thinking about it a lot in the last 24 hours. My 14-year-old is making a little movie in one of his classes at school, and he wrote a script for it. And we sat down last night and we looked at it. And the prompt, the idea that he was playing with is, okay, he's got a classroom and he wants to do kind of a scary story. And so in the classroom, the teacher at the beginning of his script says, okay, we're going to play the game Mafia. Do you know that game? It's similar to the game Assassin, where one person gets designated the assassin, and then if they look at you and blink twice, you have to like stage your, pretend like you died.
Oh, gotcha.
And then if you see the person blinking, you can accuse them of being the assassin, and that's how you win.
Gotcha.
But if you falsely accuse them, then you die.
You're out.
You know, it's like a game you play in grade school, middle school.
Sure.
And so then we workshopped that last night, and I realized that, oh, there is so much. It's only when you start to explain it that you realize, oh, there is an immense amount of craft. This isn't just something that happens. I know that also now from working in Hollywood and watching great television writers work, and that craft, and how there is a very long system of apprenticeship and training and growth in that television world that probably doesn't exist anywhere else at this point. It used to exist in the magazine world in a different way. That's the world I came up in. And it wasn't until I basically got that training that I realized, oh, I shouldn't be dismissive of this education.
Yeah.
I don't know that college does it, though.
I don't either.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly places like the Iowa's Writers' Workshop, super famous. I've met writers from there who are extremely impressive. So,
well, going from reporting to creating a story, I mean, I know like what you do, there is an extremely creative element to the way you tell someone else's story. And there's no small amount of you in any given story. I mean, just even reading your time with John McAfee, I mean, there's a lot of you in there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the kind of person who's drawn it out of you, or was the kind of person, yeah, allegedly.
Yeah.
Maybe he still is.
What? Yeah, people have asked me. I don't know. I mean, as far as I know, he's dead. He hasn't reached out to me.
You're not one of the three people who knows.
No.
I don't mean to make light of a person passing, but I'm a Memphis guy, so like an Elvis there's always that, like, I appreciate anybody who leaves a little mystique behind.
Why? That. Where did that come from, by the way? What, did Elvis seed the idea that he wasn't dead? Like, who propagated that rumor? Because I heard it as a kid.
Yeah, that's a really good next story for
there
you.
There we go.
Josh. Yeah. Let's get to work.
What are we doing? Sitting here talking, there's a real mystery to solve.
What are the origin? What if that was like where conspiracy theories really?
Yeah. What was the conspiracy theory? What was the first?
Yeah,
that is one of them.
It could, like, between that and JFK.
Yeah. Well, that's probably it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, sorry. It's very hard left sidetrack. But that going from fact to fiction to just pure creative, pure license. That's where that craft, I think. I mean, they're both important, but that the craft of fiction is so specific. Mm-hmm. And there's the formulas and the archetypes and these things that you don't fully appreciate until you start to have to explain it. Douglas Adams said the greatest way to really understand a thing is to have to explain it and break it down to a slower and dim-witted pupil. No offense to your children.
Yeah, that sounds like my children.
I have been the slow dimwit, so it's nice to get that download from somebody, but it is great to explain something to someone in a way that makes you reconsider it.
Yeah.
That leads me to, there can be only one question. Are you leaning towards a fiction project that you want to talk about?
Well, I just finished a draft of a novel with my older son.
Wow.
That's coming from Penguin Random House next year. And it's a YA romance story, superheated summer love story set in the Caribbean.
Wow.
In the world of people who live on boats.
Yeah.
Kind of like boat vagabonds.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's some specific fiction.
Yes.
Did you do some research into this?
Yeah. It's basically because I want to live on a boat and be a boat vagabond.
There you go.
I aspire to that.
You are contextualizing yourself and your subjects.
Yeah. I mean, I've got this right here. You know.
What is this? You're showing me the Virgin Islands cruising guide. Holy shit.
It's not the kind of cruising guide you might think. It's actually about sailing.
Yeah. 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 That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I love that. I mean, that you sat down. So your son is a writer. That's so cool.
Yeah.
What a strange thing to think about, that like your son, of all the many things, all the things he could do, your father was a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And now did you ever see yourself when you were in school for economics? Did you see a creative life? Did you desire a creative life? What was?
I did. I studied economics because I didn't know anything about it. And it just seemed interesting to me. I felt like I had grown up writing in my journal. I had grown up writing for myself. And like I said, I didn't feel like college was a place to study writing for whatever reason. And so I wanted to study something that was totally new to me. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't know anything about economics. And it seemed like an opportunity to go dig into something that you couldn't dig into elsewhere.
Right.
So why, you know, I wanted to go understand the way international banking worked. And how did governments work? How did the Federal Reserve work? How does a federal bank work? That was all very interesting to me. And my dad and my mother came up as film producers. My mother was an actress as well. And my dad was just a straight ahead producer. And on the one hand, he really thought that the film business was not a healthy place. So did my mother. When they split, my mother moved up here to San Francisco and I lived with her for the most part because she felt like LA wasn't a great place to raise a kid. So I had that sensibility of, the film business is particularly hard. The creative arts are a hard way to make a living. I knew that. And then on the other hand, I would go down to LA on the weekends or in the summers or go with my dad on production somewhere. And it was really exciting and really fun. And the people that you're traveling with, that comprise a film crew, it's like a expedition and an adventure. And every day you don't know how it's going to go. And you're oftentimes in interesting places. My dad was very busy during those productions, and so I was left largely to my own. And I just found it thrilling.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly, I mean, we're close to the same age. You look younger than me, which is upsetting, but fine.
We both got gray beards.
Yeah. I've just abandoned ship on mine. Mm-hmm. But the era that you came up in, the thing your dad was most well known for having produced, I imagine that was extremely exciting to be around, like the set of The Highlander. Were you on set at The Highlander?
Yeah, I was on set. I was in it. I had a brief role as an extra.
That's great.
Nobody knew at the time that it was going to become a film that people still want to talk about. His other films, he had made quite a number of other films, and none of them achieved the success and notoriety of Highlander. And so, I don't know, any given movie, you don't know what's going to happen. And it's just as hard to make a bad movie as it is to make a good movie. So, but Highlander was, for me, it was a thrilling place to be a kid. We were in Scotland.
Yeah.
Like I said, I was just kind of left on my own. I would go wander off into the Highlands all day while they were shooting, because after a certain amount of time, as I was 9 years old, 10 years old, it got boring just watching them. Because on a film set, usually there's a lot of just waiting around. And so eventually I was like, okay, I'm going to go for a walk and explore that castle up on the mountain. And I'd just go walk up there. I have this desire for that feeling of exploration that I think maybe comes from that in part.
I can't even imagine it wouldn't. It must. So that kind of brings me to the thing I'm most curious about you, and I think I've alluded to this, is your relationship with fear. Hmm. Not even just the things that you've done as in the underdog and as like a career, but the stories you've had to explore have been often very dangerous, around dangerous people and dangerous situations. But of all the things that cued me into you having a specific and very different relationship with fear is your encounter with your neighbor and the Four Tops. I mean, that the way you handled, I don't know if you want to tell an abbreviated version of that story if you want to, or if people can listen to it on Varnamtown, but like the way you handled that specific thing suggested to me that you relate to fear in a very different way. So
it's interesting. I hadn't thought of that experience from the point of view of fear, which might say something about me.
Yeah. It tells me even more.
I wasn't scared. I could see how that story might have played out differently. Essentially, my neighbor was playing the same music over and over and over again, day after day, hour after hour.
Same song
from his bathroom. And it just started, obviously, it's driving me crazy, the whole neighborhood. And this is San Francisco, so the buildings are pretty close together. And I work from home as a writer. And one day I was just eating my sandwich and I just was like, enough is enough. I can't handle it. And I walked out and his bathroom was on the second floor, but we have a fence between us. And so I climbed up the fence with my sandwich and I leaned into the screen, the insect protector, the bug protector on the window, and just kind of leaned against it while he was, as I saw, sitting on the toilet. And there was this moment of like, this could go a whole lot of, this could go many different ways. And the way it went was not what I was, what somebody might expect, but it's what I felt actually at the time. I did not feel scared or nervous or worried. I went up there just wanting, I never really spoke to this guy.
That was your first meeting.
It was our first meeting. And he kind of looked over at me and did not seem surprised. He's like, hey. And I said, hey. And I said something like, I like your music. Which, because, you know, the Four Tops, this song, yeah. Baby, I Need Your Lovin'.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Baby, I need your loving. Yeah, that over and over. Great song. You know, I do like that song. And I was trying to get where I was headed was, you're kind of fucking this song up for me.
Yeah, I don't want to hate this.
I don't want to hate this song. So I don't know, listen to something else. But I just said, I like your music. And he said, yeah, I like it too. And he was so chilled out that I got kind of brought into his chill zone. And we just stood there and I just kept eating my sandwich, standing on the fence, listening to the Four Tops. And at the end of the song, or I don't know, I finished most of my sandwich and I said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Classic line.
And I climbed down and he changed the music.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what to conclude if he did not want to see me the next day. Maybe he concluded that was weird. He has since passed away. So.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Man. You might have, that you feel responsible.
No, it was quite a ways later.
Chuck.
Yeah.
That would have been funnier.
It killed him.
If I would have had a sandwich in my hand.
Yeah. It killed him to not listen to the Four Tops.
That was the one thing keeping everything at bay.
It was killing me.
There could be only one of you.
There could be only one song.
Yeah.
That's what he thought.
Maybe there is some sort of sandwich magic that we've not really explored.
The peanut butter. Yeah.
You know, they say that like if you're having an argument with your wife, you're supposed to be naked. Oh. And you can't fight if you're naked. Oh. I've never attempted this.
It's interesting.
But maybe you can't argue with a sandwich.
That may be true. Yeah.
Maybe it's the one thing that keeps you from being like aggressive. Because, you know, a lot of Americans would have yelled at their neighbor long before you did. So anyway, my thing about fear in this context, I know that's not the scariest thing, but like the things that you've approached, the people that you've gone to see and been a part of, you are essentially with the sandwich of journalism in hand, you know, presenting this curious, benevolent force who just kind of wants to know. Like the chronicler who doesn't have to necessarily get involved, but you're right in it.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, I don't want to have you on a podcast and get a list of your fears if it's kind of creepy, but like, I mean, what?
Well, I'm scared of a lot of things. I think that part of the reason that I've been drawn to these challenging places, challenging circumstances, I don't know, when I was growing up, as I said, was going to explore places on my own. And on the one hand, that was exciting and fun. But on the other hand, I was a young kid just off there. I mean, this is like the 70s and the 80s. It was a different style of parenting. I don't remember feeling a lot of fear, but I also was a kid just wandering around foreign countries. So that must have been in there somewhere. And also it was obviously there weren't any cell phones. I had no ability to call anybody. And on many occasions I was just like left in weird circumstances. There was Highlander 2 in Argentina. The project went really sideways. There was a massive inflation in Argentina at the time. The project went over budget. The completion bond company took over the film, and my dad went back to the States at one point, and he left me in Argentina with $100 bill. And I was 13, I think.
Wow.
And he didn't quite say when he was coming back. He said he did say he was coming back. But he just, I guess, felt that I would be fine. And $100 at that time was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so I just was there in Argentina, and I had made some Argentinian friends, and we all went to Uruguay with the $100. And it was a very exciting, interesting time. I made some lifelong friends. But again, that's a little bit of the, and so when I go into these circumstances now as an adult, as a professional journalist, there's something in me that is seeking out instability, something that's seeking out things on the edge. When I would go to I remember going to Iraq in 03 during the war, and part of me was thinking that I wanted to test myself, to see if I could stay calm, to see if I could do my job in the most trying circumstances. And I think that's part of it as well, is like testing oneself. And there's a positive way to interpret that and a negative way to interpret that.
Well, it seems like you were given this, you were given like a sense of agency over yourself and immediately shown that you could do the adult world pretty, so long as you had the means.
Yeah.
You know, the $100. Did you go over budget?
Oh yeah. No, we ran out of money in Uruguay and then we had a real problem.
Okay. But you survived it. Yeah. And that's so skipping forward many, many years, when I saw Epic and got to know sort of what it is that you're doing, the way I look at Epic, anything that's Epic is something that you have survived.
Hmm.
You know, that's it's like the, every story that's great is because you made it through. If it's with, you know, with this just tragic ending of a kid vanishing in Uruguay, that wouldn't be such a hip story, but that you survived it is Epic.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And that you've got this sense of agency over like your own capacity and your, whatever your relationship is with fear. Cause I don't think like fearless people have no fear. Maybe like Alex Honnold or one of those people, but for the most part, a fearless person is someone who just understands what that fear is.
Yeah. I think of myself the opposite way. I am fearful and I am interested in that fear. I want to go to a place where that fear is evident so I can understand it, you know? I think of one way of thinking about it is going on adventures. What is an adventure? An adventure is something that you don't know the outcome. You don't know what's going to happen. If you know what's going to happen, it's not an adventure. So what is that? What does that mean? Why do we want to go on adventures? It's because we want to feel the uncertainty. And why do we want that? And I think when you get down to it all, to get deep here, we're all going to die. That's out there. We don't know why we're here. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what death is. So there's all these efforts to try to create routine that helps us feel like things are predictable when underneath it all, none of it's predictable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except for death.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, what's your relationship with death? Is it something you think about?
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. I think my thought process, my thinking on it has changed over the years. The way I felt about it in my 20s is different now than I think about it in my 40s. I think about the limited, now in my 40s, I think about the limited time I have left. In my 20s, I took a lot of risks, the war, covering the wars, being in the war zones that I was in, up until essentially 2012, at which point I was in my 30s. In 2012, I was in Libya and then left Libya and went to Belize to go spend time with John McAfee. So that was kind of a double whammy. And at that point, that was a reckoning moment where I came back from those two experiences and said, okay, listen, I already had kids at that point. I had two young kids. And I thought, this is maybe not the right path for me now. Also, the economics of journalism were changing. It was harder. I could see the winds of change in journalism, that this type of investigative work that I was doing had a cap to it. And at the same time, I saw other opportunities, and that's why I created Epic in 2013. You know, so there was some dovetailing of things going on at that moment related to death.
Yeah. Those two stories, McAfee and the Arab Spring Break, are they were so fascinating to me. And I just kept on, as I've been going through your writing and what you've done, I was like, God, why does this sound so familiar? And I read, I picked up Krakauer, Into the Wild. I was like, that's the guy, that McCandles, the kid that didn't make it out of the woods. His story is the tragic end, and you know where yours left off with
Chris, yeah,
Chris, yeah. And with the with McAfee, he was still alive at that point, yeah. And so like the tragedy of it wasn't the whole story; it was the epic survival,
yeah,
and these like weirdly driven people.
You're right about that. If somebody dies, like I don't like covering stories of murder. I don't like covering bleak, dark stories. Yeah. I do like it when people survive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's epic.
Yeah. You know, if everyone dies, it's not epic.
Yeah.
It's an epic fail.
Or it's just the epic scale of being dead forever is just, it's a lot to, mm-hmm. it's a lot to put in your pocket. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Epic. I mean, this venture with your other pal, Josh, mm-hmm. that was the rules of the club. You have to be named Josh.
You have to be named Josh, yeah. And,
all right, what you guys put together and what you've done with it so far, the way you've grown it, I think is really fascinating that you're using part of it to tell stories for brands and turning journalism in that way. Because it is, it's odd, the journalism of advertising.
Yeah, I had not thought about it. Essentially what happened was, we were finding stories all over the world and publishing them as articles. And then the articles, more often than not, were being adapted into films and television. They would go into the Hollywood machine. And we, at the beginning of Epic, had a deal at 20th Century Fox. And we used the money from that deal to bring on board a bunch of journalists that other Josh and I would send around the world to go find stories that we were interested in. And I started calling them story hunters and say, okay, hey, eventually it got kind of open-ended where I would give somebody, you know, a few $1,000 and say, go to South America and come back when you're broke and you've got some good stories to tell.
Right.
And if they came back and they didn't have stories that were really gripping about other people's experiences with life, then they weren't right for the job. And if they did, they stayed with us. And one day I met somebody from a big company here in San Francisco, and it was a friend of a friend, and we were having a drink and I was explaining just that. And he said, hey, I wonder if we could hire you and your story hunters to go find stories about our customers. Because the traditional way advertising works is they hire an advertising agency with a bunch of very talented, creative people who basically just make something up, you know, a slogan or in a 30-second commercial with a bunch of actors playing the role of customers. And that, to me, seems backwards. As a reporter approaching that business, I would say, no, you have to start at the ground level. You have to go interview a bunch of customers and find a story of a customer who's used the thing you've made in a way that is meaningful to them and tell that story, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, yeah.
At least for me. And so that's what we started doing about 10 years ago. And we have now done it for many of the world's largest companies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite cool. I like that idea of taking the journalism of advertising.
Yeah.
In this way that is at least genuine.
Yeah, why make it up? If the company is making something that people are paying for, it means that they want it, hopefully, that it has value to them. And that's your campaign.
I mean, it's funny. This is a nice segue back to Varnamtown because you guys do advertising. And one of the things I like the most about Varnamtown is just your banter with Kyle is just, it's great. I mean, you guys have a really cool, simpatico, funny way of getting along. And then like there's this moment where you're talking about some serious thing or whatever funny thing. And then there's just this like barely pause. But it's somehow we just know that that pause means we're going to start talking about something else.
Yeah.
And you guys just suddenly, and I don't know if I mentioned these companies, if you get a kickback, but suddenly it's like, so you use HelloFresh.
Yeah.
You know,
like, yeah.
It's that there's this whole other way of advertising things now that is, to me, so much more compelling
yeah.
than a weird, so I don't have a television. So when I do see commercials, for many years, I only ever saw TV on mute, like in a bar or restaurant. Mm-hmm. I was like, what the fuck is this? It's like a weird series of hallucinations. Like modern yeah. advertising is so bizarre to me.
I agree.
Like, it's like, what? This was about Sprite?
Yeah.
How the fuck is this about Sprite?
You know? Yeah. Those are all those Super Bowl ads.
I didn't even see them. But you know, but now this model, like where people, you know, just talk about an experience with a thing. I quite like that. Yeah. And that's, we're like in a very interesting age of storytelling. That there's more of a value on it again. We lost it for
yeah.
kind of a while, but it seems like it's really powerful.
I hope so. I think we need it.
Yeah.
I know I need it.
I saw funny similarities between McAfee and Varnamtown, like McAfee's time in Belize,
mm-hmm.
which there was almost like a Varnamtown in Belize that was some, according to him, maybe totally fictitiously involved in the corruption and yeah. drug trade and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it had this weird charismatic character in the center and, you know.
Yeah. And also John was from the South, you know, he's from Virginia.
That's right.
I when I was hearing the accents at the time, I was thinking of John.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a funny, I'm also from the South, but I think I don't drink very much anymore. And I think that might've been the key, the linchpin to me losing my Southern accent.
Yeah. When you do drink, it comes out.
I think so.
Yeah. Where are you from in the South?
Memphis.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah. I liked your story of working in the, not crawfish, catfish, the all you can eat catfish yeah. restaurant with the woman from Egypt.
Yeah.
Have you stayed in touch with her?
No.
Is she still with us?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've not stayed.
She was like the catfish queen of Tennessee, Mississippi,
right? That's right.
Tennessee.
Yeah.
She didn't seem very happy.
I mean, it might have just been, you know, as a 12, 13-year-old, you don't really have a lot of context for,
yeah, how people react, how people, managers act,
yeah.
you know,
and
our owners.
Yeah, what is dark longing and what is just somebody's affectation to like just deal with redneck teenagers when they're out, you know, like, right. I didn't know.
Right.
But she seriously did not like me. that I'm new.
Yeah.
But
she thought you were lazy.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, in some level, she might have been right. I don't wash dishes anymore.
How long did you work in the Empire State Building?
Not long, just a few months.
Because I've read that you were, or heard that you were a wealth manager. So how do you manage wealth for just 2 months?
No. I worked in a money management firm with, I was 19, 20. I was 20 years old, mm-hmm. out of my fucking mind. I was crazy. Mm-hmm. I had no, did not belong there whatsoever. My brother-in-law, it was his firm.
Oh, I
so
see.
He kind of had me on deck. Yeah. Just, I was filling in. My bike had been stolen. I was a bicycle messenger. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was a fill-in and it was wild. They kind of wanted, they're like, hey man, take your Series 7, learn this shit. Come on, do this thing. And I was so...
Did you take your Series 7?
No, hell no. The only time I made any money was actual gambling.
Right.
At that time.
Yeah.
Like it was during the dot-com crash.
Yeah.
So all these guys were making all this crazy money and they sent me to the OTB to place a bet. And there was like a very sketchy sort of situation where a guy came up there and was like, they sort of traded, you know?
Uh-huh.
So they would place bets for him on Wall Street. And he was like, oh, you need to. And so he gave us a trifecta.
I see.
And I knew nothing about the OTB, about racing.
Yeah.
And I'd just gotten my paycheck. It was Friday. And I put my whole paycheck on that horse.
How'd it go?
On those three horses. I won.
Yeah.
Totally won. I was like.
When you win the trifecta, it's more than double.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I don't even remember. That's how bad in green. I don't even remember.
And did that change your approach to gambling? It might turn people into a gambler.
It scared the shit out of me because I hate to turn this. Enough about you, Josh. Let's talk about you. My grandfather was a bank robber and was like. He was kind of a degenerate gambler.
In Mississippi?
In Illinois, actually. He worked for the Irish mob. There's a whole whole crazy story there. But he was a gambler and a liar. And like, it kind of freaked me out. I was like, oh my God. Because you get that first taste of winning. You're like, oh my God, this is easy. I could just keep.
Yeah.
But I fortunately did not become a gambler. there's like certain things you just know you're not suited for. Mm-hmm. Like, was that Seinfeld thing? I can't be an orgy guy. What, I got to wear like robes and grow a mustache? I didn't want to be a gambling guy. You know, mm-hmm. like can't stand at a funny angle with a cigar and mm-hmm. be pissed off all the door. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't for me.
But, well, it sounds like you tried on a lot of different jobs.
I'm always, I've never been bored. And even though I've not had much financial success, I feel when I weigh it against that being dead forever mm-hmm. thing, I feel fine about it. You know? Mm-hmm. At least that's what people like me have to tell themselves to.
Well, it's you know, the people who are in the opposite side of things, who are working jobs that make a lot of money, that require a lot of them, they, you know, the grass is greener. They want the freedom. They want to go travel the world. There's like a whole list of things that they want, but they get trapped by the expectations.
That's a big thing. I've been in both situations.
I like your saying that you want to retire early and often.
That's the goal, right? I don't know about you. Did your family get to retire? Did you have people who made it into old age?
My dad never retired exactly.
But by choice.
As a film producer.
He liked it.
He had a love-hate relationship with the film business. And my mother is retired now. And successfully retired.
Nicely done.
Yeah. Cheers. I mean, semi-successfully. She doesn't want to go back to work, but she keeps busy.
Yes. You know?
She reads a lot. I don't know. She always seems to be doing something.
Have you found, like you were saying, you know, meeting these people and going through these experiences, challenges, what you think is true about the universe and life and everything. But that, like, for instance, I've found that the most content people and the people with the greatest sense of well-being have a few things in common. And one of them is a sense of purpose, whatever that is, whether it's like, I'm the guy who picks up the trash and I like being the guy who gets the trash out of here, or that person who tells stories or whatever it is. Have you found things like that, that you can track across disparate groups and misfits? And
I don't know. I don't know what makes somebody happy.
Yeah.
And sometimes I even doubt the value of happiness. Is that the goal?
To be happy?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think so.
Because if it is the goal, I don't know. It's not, to me, it's a shifting target.
Yeah.
Because what might make you happy at one moment could be different another moment. And I don't mean moment to moment. I mean like year to year, month to month.
Right. But I draw a distinction between happiness and well-being.
Yeah.
You know, happiness is an orgasm, is a cookie, is a thing that happens, or a feeling. But well-being is like,
it's like a marketing push.
Right.
Wellness.
Wellness.
What is wellness?
What is wellness?
You can buy it. You can buy it, actually.
Yeah.
I have a wellness pills.
Pills?
Yeah.
I know there's trackers that tell you how well you may or may not be doing.
No, I have wellness pills.
Wellness.
That's the secret.
It's just a pill.
Yeah, I could show you.
I've heard that a headache is not exactly a lack of aspirin, but perhaps unwellness is a lack of the pill.
Yeah, well, no, seriously, I do have a lot of wellness pills. I'll go get them, I'll show you.
You're not joking.
Yeah.
I kept on waiting for the punchline.
No, that's it.
Josh is getting up from the microphone. He's walking to the door. He's entered the hallway. He's now running in what would only be described as a well-man fashion, presumably grabbing the pills. I hear rustling. More running. Josh is returning with an entire bag. They are the wellness formula. Wow. Well, we're not going to do an ad for these people.
Yeah, those are my wellness pills.
Well done.
I actually haven't been taking them for a few days.
Are you feeling all right?
I kind of feel the same.
Yeah.
But I guess my point of view is, I do believe in them, but my point of view is whether or not they have any value in and of themselves, the placebo effect is real. It's like an intention. When I take it every morning, I have an intention to feel good.
Yeah. And to ingest wellness.
To ingest wellness. I'm literally ingesting wellness as an idea.
Yeah.
It's weird. The logo is kind of weird. It's like a planet rising on top of another planet on top of another planet.
Yeah.
I don't know why that says wellness.
Well, it's got that whole kind of Eucharist holy symbolism sort of thing going on.
I'm going to take one right now.
Yeah, why not?
I didn't take one today.
Oh, shit.
I didn't take one yesterday.
Are you on a full stomach? Is it one of those kind of pills?
No, I usually take them in the morning.
All right.
There's no water.
Yeah, sorry.
You want one?
No. Just in case I don't get hooked, you know. I don't want to be a gambler. I don't want to be hooked on wellness. Mm. All right.
I feel like, particularly when I'm feeling a little sick, I take two.
Oh.
And knock on wood, I haven't been sick for a long time.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah.
So that's it. The sense of well-being is being able to count the distance between illness and wellness.
Maybe, but even being sick sometimes can be good because it slows you down. It stops you from engaging in the routine. It's a break in the routine.
Yeah. And a reminder of just how fragile and vulnerable a thing you are.
Yeah, it's like when you get a cut on your finger or anywhere really, and you're like, oh shit, I never thought about my finger that much.
Yeah, how often am I touching my ring finger? Why?
Yeah, never.
Yeah, and it's like a magnet for your spouse. She will knock into it.
Yep.
Or he will knock into it.
Yeah.
Inevitably. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll get bumped.
Well, Farnham Town is my new favorite show. Man, I listened to it on the way over here because it came out.
Yesterday was episode 4.
Yeah.
The Chinese Connection. So
Thursdays. It's coming out every Thursday.
It comes out every Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why am I getting Thursday? Maybe I get that sometimes, my little podcatcher.
It pushed it to you today?
Yeah, I just got it today.
Okay.
Downloaded tonight or maybe at midnight. Maybe it came out. Whatever. Midweek.
Yeah,
you
midweek.
Can look forward. We can look forward to episodes of Farnham Town.
There's 8 episodes, so we've got another 4 weeks to go.
Are you completing the story? Is it cliffhanging to season 2?
No, it's completing. It's completing. Kyle and I may go somewhere else next.
Yeah. I mean, I hope people are encouraging you to do that. I really like the banter between you two. And I got to say, his social media is pretty good.
He's great.
It's quite good.
It's very funny. He's really plugged in, you know, like he's engaging with Lord and all these other celebrities.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I didn't get to talk to you about that I do want to talk to you about, maybe you can another time if you don't have time, but is music in storytelling.
Mm.
I that's the one thing as a writer, I feel like bereft of being able to weave music into it.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really appreciate, and I don't know how much engagement you had in this, but especially Little America, the music direction on that and the choices and the way that music helps tell the story was so good.
Yeah.
Is that something you're engaging with?
On Little America, I wasn't day to day on that.
Mm-hmm.
On Farnham Town, I was. We didn't have a music supervisor on Farnham Town. And so maybe you can tell, you know, like
no, you guys have made good use of that. You've got a couple of different.
Yeah. There's some tracks that I did commission some original music. It's like with a podcast, you're moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
Little America, we had a very large team. The music in Little America is great. And in general, it's the difference between a visual, audio-visual world and something that's just the words on the page.
Yeah, and that just also the way, you know, if you're talking, like today you guys were talking about this poor sweet cop ending up in Miami.
Yeah.
And that shopping, when you two were talking about this cop, you had like this kind of Miami, you know, 80s Miami stuff playing in the background that was just so hip.
Yeah,
I thought it was quite good.
Yeah, when I remember choosing that music and laying it in under that scene of Larry Joyner going to Miami, who's a cop, a traffic cop from the Farnham Town area, and he gets roped into this DEA task force takedown mission to Miami. And so we're imagining what it looks like for this traffic cop to suddenly land in Miami Beach in the early 80s at the height of the cocaine cowboy madness.
Yeah.
And they're going undercover. to take down a major narco trafficker. And so Larry can't just wear, obviously he can't wear his street cop, you know, he's a right. uniform cop.
Right.
So he's got to wear something to try to blend in. But how is Larry ever going to blend in? And so I just love that image of Larry wearing the like Hawaiian tropical shirt, sipping Mai Tais in Miami Beach, trying to blend in when everybody could tell he's a cop.
Right. Yeah. Is he the Tubbs or the Crockett in this?
They're all wannabe. Everybody wants to be, well, Crockett or Tubbs, really. Or, yeah, they're both super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. They are.
Yeah.
The suits. Come on.
The t-shirt underneath. Yeah.
Well, Josh, man, thank you. Is there anything like, and I know you get the opportunity to say things to the public all the time, but if there's any one thing you would say maybe to your mom or to your kids or to your wife or somebody that you haven't seen in many years, is there a message you want to send out into the universe?
Well,
take your wellness pills.
Take your wellness pills. I do think about the idea of putting yourself out in the world, of not getting too comfortable with the routine, to break up your routine. Yeah, I think about that.
And you try shit.
Yeah.
I think there's like a family crest, maybe have try shit.
Yeah. In there. I joke with my kids that if I were to have a headstone, a tombstone, it would say, Joshua Davis, he tried.
If I didn't end it right there, I'd be not doing my job correctly. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah. I like the idea of like, I even tried not to die, but that didn't work.
Hello there. Did you enjoy that episode? We had a good time making it. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by leaving us a review, rating us, or saying something nice to someone you know. You can do all those things on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, or you can just send us a note. Our website is mtp.dog. That's .dog. It's a real thing. Just type it in, you'll see. And send me an email. Tell me what you think, recommend a guest, or just, you know, rant. I'll take it. Until next time, I hope you're doing fun and interesting things.